As we consider the Middle Ages, we need to come to the rise of Islam, AD 632, a very terrible date in church history, as you could see this as part of God's judgment on a corrupt and lukewarm, backslidden church. The church had become so weak and worldly that Islam rose as a rebuke and as a challenge and as a judgment upon a weak church. Because if the church was as dynamic as it had been in earlier centuries, Islam could not have arisen. And it couldn't have taken all the conquest that it did. Islam only survived and only flourished because of the weakness of the Christians in not being able to resist them at that time. The result of the rise of Islam from AD 632, which marks the death of Muhammad, is the annihilation of the Christian communities throughout North Africa and the Middle East. North Africa had been the strongest part of Christianity in the early church. The greatest names in early church history had been from North Africa. Origen, Cyprian, Ignatius, Tertullian, Athanasius, Augustine. And now North Africa almost wiped out by the spread of Islam. Absolute catastrophe. As these rampaging hordes of Muslims, these jihadists, just spread the terror of Islam by the sword across North Africa, across the Middle East, all the way through Persia, which had been strongly evangelized and Christianized before. In the first 100 years of Islam, in the first century of Islam, from 632 to 732, over 3,200 Christian churches were destroyed. Absolutely devastating how it caused such a regression in the advance of Christianity as Islam came and attacked the church and took the cross and deliberately lowered it and enslaved so many of these Christians. Here you can see depicted piles of skulls of Christians decapitated and their wives or mothers embracing, imagine, just the decapitated head of their loved ones. Exactly 100 years after the death of Muhammad, 732, he died in 632. So in 732, Charles Martel, the Hammer, stops the Muslim advance at the Battle of Tours, or Poitiers, in France. And you can see where the Battle of Tours or Poitiers was very deep into Europe. The whole of Europe was in danger of falling to Islam. Islam had even taken Spain and Portugal and were racing across the Pyrenees Mountains into France itself, into the heart of Europe. But they were stopped at the Battle of Tours, or Battle of Poitiers, by Charles Martel the Hammer. And this marked the high water mark of Islam's advance. And from 732 AD, they started to retreat. And Europe started to be protected. Inspired by Muhammad's doctrine of jihad, the Saudi Arabians launched the first truly colonial enterprise in history. Arabs invaded and colonized Palestine, Syria, Jerusalem, Egypt, Persia, Spain, Sicily. Even Rome was conquered and sacked by Muslim jihadists by 846. And so the Muslims were colonizing the whole world, and it's an interesting thing that you think Arabic is the language of Arabia. Saudi Arabia. But Arabic became the official language in the whole of North Africa. There's seven African countries where Arabic is the official language. Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt. These countries, Sudan, these countries were not Arab, but they've been colonized by the Arabs. The Muslims invaded and colonized Spain for 800 years. Portugal for 600 years, Greece for 500 years, Bulgaria for 500 years, Romania for 400 years, Serbia for 400 years, Sicily for 300 years, Hungary for 150 years. You know, when you think of colonialism, people might think of the French and the Portuguese and the British. The British and the French weren't in Africa that long compared to what the Arabs were in Europe, colonizing and oppressing the people of Europe. And the shocking oppression of the people in Sudan over the last 500 years by Islam. Absolutely hideous. Muslims also struggled but failed to conquer Malta. They also struggled but failed to conquer Austria. There were several sieges of Vienna. In fact, Vienna, the heart of Europe, was besieged back in 526 and also it was besieged in 1683. And you know when the siege of Malta was lifted? The 11th of September, 1565. And when was the siege of Vienna? the other high water mark of Islam, lifted 11th of September, 1683. When the Muslims chose 11th of September for a terrorist attack on America, it wasn't accidental. They chose an important historic date. They know the history. We need to know our history. Then we'll understand what the Muslims are doing. These were dates of two of the biggest defeats of Islam ever. And so they chose it to change September the 11th into a Muslim victory. A terror attack on the World Trade Center in New York as a result. Muslims struggled but failed to conquer Italy. They did conquer Italy, but then the Italians hired Vikings to come in. The Vikings are the best soldiers of all. And they wiped out the Muslims, and the Muslims were chased out, and Italy was freed from Islam. The Muslims tried to conquer Cyprus, the island of Cyprus, but they were able to be kicked out mainly by the hard work of Richard the Lionheart, one of the crusaders. Muslims also struggled but failed to conquer Armenia and Poland, Georgia, Ukraine, and Russia itself. Bosnia, Kosovo, Albania, which were Muslim colonies for hundreds of years, continue to be areas of intense violence and destabilization to this day. When people wonder, why is there so much violence in Kosovo and Bosnia? Well, if you know your history and you understand Islamic Jihad, it'll make all the sense. I've ministered in these countries, and the people have not forgotten what Islam has done to them. And today, the violence is being stirred by Muslim jihadists funded by Saudi Arabia. And so, 732 AD, Poitiers, or Tours in France, Charles Martel Hammer, turning back six furious waves of the Islamic cavalry attacks, and that was the turning point. You wonder why so much attention has been given to the Crusades, which lasted less than 200 years. Why are they not giving attention to the Islamic Jihad that is so much bigger and longer lasting? It's lasted 1,400 years, and Islamic Jihad is continuing to this day. It's intensifying in this day. People in northern Nigeria, the churches being burned down and bombed. Churches in Egypt being attacked. Churches in Sudan being bombed. Why Islamic Jihad? But people are wanting to talk about the Crusades that ended 700 years ago, but why don't they talk about Jihad that continues to this day? The portrayal of the Crusades as an imperialistic and colonial enterprise against peace-loving and tolerant Muslims minding their own business, it's nothing but imaginative fiction, a myth. It's lies and disinformation. While the Encyclopedia Britannica could publish pages on the Crusades, there's not even a paragraph on Jihad in the Encyclopedia Britannica. But the Crusades are only a belated reaction to centuries of Islamic Jihad. You can't pay attention to the Crusades without seeing what it was reacting to, which was Jihad. Seldom do modern historians or journalists recognize that the Crusaders were a military response to Islamic Jihad. It was Christian Europe's military response to five centuries of Islamic aggression against Christian lands. The Crusades reacted to the systematic abuse and the persecution of indigenous Christian populations in these lands which Muslims had invaded. This is a picture from 1915 of Christian women being crucified in Armenia. 1.5 million Christians were murdered by the Muslim Turks in 1915. That's not that long ago. It's barely 100 years ago. This portrait that the Muslims produced, it was a whole wall-sized portrait, shows Mehmed II, Mehmed the Magnificent, who conquered Constantinople, the greatest city in the world at that time, slaughtered the entire population. How does he depict his victory in the gates of Constantinople? Is he standing over the armored figure of a knight? No. The portrait shows a Christian woman, a princess. She's got blonde hair, a golden crown on her head, dressed in a white dress. His horse is standing over a non-combatant, a civilian, a woman, obviously a Christian woman, showing the contempt of Islam for women and showing contempt of Islam for civilians. Here he's portraying a military victory by showing slaughtering a defenseless civilian. Professor Thomas Madden is considered one of the world's top authorities on the Crusades. And he says the Crusades are quite possibly the most misunderstood event in European history. So I've given a chapter on the Crusades in this book because of the fact that you will be asked about the Crusades. And often people will bring up not just Muslims but secular humans. You Christians, the Crusades. or the Inquisition, which we'll get to later. So you need to understand a bit about the Crusades. In 1999, at the 900th anniversary of the liberating of Jerusalem from the Muslims, many Christians took part in a so-called reconciliation walk, traveling to Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, asking Muslims for forgiveness for what the ancestors may or may not have done during the Crusades 900 years earlier. Had these individuals known their history, they would have realized that these were previously Christian lands which the Muslims had invaded. Muslims massacred tens of thousands of Christians. They desecrated and destroyed over 30,000 churches before the Crusades began. They demolished some of the most important churches in Christendom, like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the most holy place in all of Christianity, destroyed by the Muslims. Muslims seem obsessed with the Christian Crusades, but they've forgotten their own jihad. The unintended consequence of such well-meaning but obviously misinformed Christians apologizing for the Crusades is that it encourages Muslim radicalism. It shows them Western Christians are weak and stupid. There's nothing the Muslims respect more than strength. They still respect Richard the Lionheart, because he knew how to fight them. There's nothing they despise more than weakness. Kissing their toes does not make them respect us. Christian apologies for the Crusades encourages the self-righteousness that's endemic in Islam. Muslims are full of self-congratulation, always walking around patting themselves on the back, and we're more Christian than the Christians. We're more Jewish than the Jews. It just encourages them. When Christians apologize, oh, I'm so sorry for the Crusades. Well, I'm not. The Crusades saved Europe. The Crusades were a reaction against jihad. Muslims don't need any encouragement to hate us, but these Christian apologies to the Crusades only encourages the Muslim self-righteousness and their hatred of Christians in general. And we need to look at other important things in history. Another major event in church history is AD 800. Charlemagne was crowned the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which was an attempt to reconstitute a Christian Europe. The Holy Roman Empire is basically Germany, but it encompassed further than Germany to encompass Bohemia and Austria and parts of the Franks and many key parts. So the Empire of Charlemagne was huge. Another major event in church history is AD 878. King Alfred the Great began the conversion of the Vikings and he laid the foundation of the common law of England. And so, because King Alfred is so important, and you'll see why in a moment, there's a chapter on him. You'll see from page 20 in the Church History Manual, we've got a chapter on King Alfred the Great. He's the only king of England that was called great, and you'll see why in a moment. So, 878, the beginning of the conversion of the great Viking peoples, or the Scandinavians, started by the enemy, King Alfred the Great. Now, just a word about this. My ancestors, the Hammonds, were Vikings. So we would have been enemies of King Alfred. We were the ones invading. But I look at King Alfred as my spiritual forefather, because it was through him that the original Vikings, the original Hammonds, started to come to Christ. Here's a reformer king. King Alfred of Wessex spent most of his life fighting against the invading Danes. He was a real freedom fighter. He is the only king in English history known as the Great. His reign has been recognized as one of the most important turning points in English political and church history, but also in civilization. He lived through tumultuous times, and he's recognized as one of the most intelligent, devout, industrious, effective of all kings of the Middle Ages. Alfred was both soldier and scholar. You can see here he's got the axe and he's got the law. The scroll representing the dooms or the common law of England, and the axe, because, you know, one is authority, the other is power. Alfred was both a scholar and a soldier, a lawmaker and an educator. He was an author and he was a reformer. He was born the fourth son of Aethelwulf and Osberth in Wantage in 849. And his mother taught him a love of knowledge, and at a young age he responded to a challenge that whichever of her children first learned to read a beautifully illuminated Saxon book of poetry would have it for their own. He dedicated himself to the task and he won the prize. He loved reading. This was the characteristic of his life: love for literature, hunger for knowledge, passion for advancing the English literature. And a fourth son of the king was not expected to come to rule, but the death of his brother Æthelred in battle against the Danes propelled him to the throne. When each of his brothers had died ahead of him, he was suddenly, even though he's fourth born, he suddenly becomes the head of Wessex, West Saxons, or the most powerful of the kingdoms of England. And for most of 30 years that he was king, Alfred was a soldier who led his people in a desperate war for survival. He personally commanded in 54 pitched battles. He frequently fought against overwhelming odds. In just the first 5 months of 870, he fought 9 pitched battles against the Danish Vikings. He was defeated at Reading, but a few days later he turned this into victory at Ashdown. At the Battle of Ashdown, January 874, was critically important. If the West Saxons had been beaten, all of England would have sunk into heathen anarchy. Since they were victorious, the hope still burned for a civilized Christian island. This was the first time the invaders had been beaten in the field. The Vikings had never been beaten before Ashdown, when Alfred beat them. There was another battle at Bassing, which was inconclusive. This is followed by a defeat for the Saxons at Marton. And it was at this battle that his brother Æthelred died, and Alfred then became king. Shortly after this, he fought the Danes to stand still at Wilton, but as the result was indecisive. He proved too stubborn a foe for easy subjugation, and so resistance secured them 5 uneasy years of peace in which to consolidate as the Vikings left them alone, because they realized these Saxons are a tough nut to crack. In the uneasy peace that followed, Alfred recognized and reorganized his army. He started to rebuild his realm, which had suffered under the merciless ravages of these Danish Vikings. Many towns and villages had been raided and plundered, and London fell to the Danes, and Northumbria and East Anglia were firmly under Danish control. And Alfred realized it's vital to create a navy to effectively defend England from the seafaring Danes. The Danes are attacking by sea. We're an island people. We cannot defend the island if we don't have a strong navy. And so in a real sense, Alfred is called the father of the English navy. He's the one who first built genuine naval ships, and they managed to beat the Vikings at sea, which is their strongest point. Alfred also instilled a great respect for law and order in his kingdom. It was said a traveller might leave a valuable jewel hanging on a bush by the roadside and nobody would touch it. That's how well people respected property under him. Alfred brought scholars from Europe to help educate his people. He was determined to give his nation a stable system of law based on God's law. He blended Mosaic law, the laws of Moses, with the Sermon on the Mount of Christ and Germanic customs, and his dooms began with the full 10 commandments. The common law of England, written by King Alfred, begins with, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of bondage in the house of Egypt. You have to have no other gods before me." One by one, each of the 10 commandments. And then the golden rule of Christ, and a lot of the Sermon on the Mount and other biblical principles are written in to the first laws written, which was the common law of England. In 876, the Danes launched a surprise offensive. They seized Wareham, besieged Exeter, took Devon, besieged Kenwith Castle, and when they captured Kenwith, they put all inhabitants to the sword. Alfred was defeated at Chippingham, forced to retreat. Wessex was in danger of falling under the shadow of Odin's bird. You know, we have Wednesday. It's named after Woden, Woden's Day, or Odin, the most powerful of the Viking gods. And Thursday is named after Thor, the god of war, the god of thunder, the god of lightning. And Frigday, or Friday. Friday is named after another of the Viking gods. Tor was another of the Viking gods. Frey was the Viking goddess of fertility. So 4 of the days of the week are named after Viking gods, actually, showing the impact of the Vikings on the English language. The great raven of Odin is taken as the symbol of the Danes. So Alfred's forces were defeated, and they fled to the Isle of Athelney amongst the forests and the marshes. And they basically had to hide in the swamps. And it was here that Alfred burned the cakes. Now, some people might have heard of this. Here's this King of England. He's in disguise. He's working as a guerrilla behind the lines, effectively. And his host asks him to watch the cakes that are being baked. And he's so deep in thought, considering his strategies, that he failed to notice the cakes burning. And he is berated by this irate housewife who came back and hit him over the head with the broomstick. Now, after reorganizing his forces, Alfred surprised the Danes after force marching his soldiers 40 miles in a day. And the Battle of Edington in Wiltshire was a decisive victory for Alfred, and it's still known as Slaughterford because of the vast amount of people who died in that battle. After reorganizing his forces, after this battle, he had a great white horse cut into the ridge to commemorate. You can still see it to this day, this major victory. Alfred, at this battle, forced King Guthrum of the Danes, along with 30 of his earls, to be baptized as Christians. These were the first Viking converts to Christianity. He beat them in battle, and so he could enslave them or kill them. But he chose to set them free on condition they convert to Christianity and be baptized. Interesting, but this is how it started. The Danes withdrew from Alfred's territory until 884 when they attempted another invasion. This time Alfred gained a swift victory. He seized London in 885. He fortified it strongly. And thereafter he received the submission of the leaders of the Angles and the Saxons from several princes of Wales. So Alfred at this point became the first king of all of England. Before that was many different kingdoms. And so Alfred is known as the Great because he's the first true king of England. And then they met more battles against the Danes, defeated them in Farheim, and again in Thorney and Benfleet, and outmaneuvered and outfought the Vikings, who were considered the greatest soldiers in the world. He forced marched his army to Exeter and drove out the besiegers. And at this point, the newly formed English navy attacked the galleys of the invading Danes at sea and defeated them. So this is absolutely extraordinary. The unbeaten Danes, who for two centuries had rampaged wherever they wanted, stopped dead by the Saxons, who proved they were the equal of any Viking. And as a large number of Danes marched up the Thames Valley, a lot of fierce battles took place. And the Danish garrison at Chester was besieged and forced to retreat. And then he prevented the Danes resupplying the forces by obstructing the Thames River. And he forced them out of his kingdom. This was an important reverse, and it was the beginning of the conversion of the Vikings. Through virtue and valor, through tactics and tenacity, Alfred fought the Viking invaders to a standstill and turned them out of the country. He succeeded in uniting a fragmented series of dominions around England against a common foe. And his Christian courage was an inspiration to all. He was a real dedicated evangelical Christian. He enjoyed over 32 years in marriage to Ealhswith of the royal family of Mercia. They raised 3 daughters and 2 sons. His son Edward and daughter Ethelfrida, the Lady of the Mercians, later defeated the Danes and liberated all of England, completing the father's work. Now, having rescued his country from invasion, he set to work reforming the laws, the customs, and the personality of his people. He personally translated many of the Latin works into Anglo-Saxon so that English people could read them. He was amongst the first to translate any of the Bible into English. Up till then, if you want to read the Bible, you have to read it in Latin. He translated Bede's Ecclesiastical History, Aristoteles' Universal History, Gregory's Pastoral Theology, Aesop's Fables, Boethius' Consolidation of Philosophy, and the Psalms of David. Alfred was also the author of many titles, including a book against unjust judges. He desired every Englishman to read. So he devised a plan for the general education of the people. First time any king had been planning to educate the entire population. He donated half his personal income to church schools. He taught that for a kingdom to be effective, it needed men of prayer, men of war, and men of work. He insisted his nobles learn to read and learn the great history and heritage of Christianity. King Alfred wrote, local government ought to be synonymous with local Christian virtue. Otherwise, it becomes local tyranny, local corruption, local iniquity. That is good insight. Let's apply it to our own society. Local government ought to be synonymous with local Christian virtue. Otherwise, it becomes local tyranny, local corruption, local iniquity. Oh, we could write that in any country of the world today. That is true. He founded 2 monasteries and numerous schools. His charities were numerous. He received and cared for foreigners and strangers in his court. He allocated 1/8 of his revenue for the poor and the needy. He instituted a system of fortified posts, which are called burghs, and he established a national militia, the Fyrd, ensuring that common people were armed, trained, and organized for local defense and could be called up quickly if they came under attack. He enlarged and improved the English fleet, which then provided protection for the whole island. He also entrenched and enforced the law of God as the common law of England. And to this day, it still is meant to be the common law of England. Historians have noted that while the world has had other examples of kings who've been good generals or great magistrates, no other sovereign did more in battle, in rulemaking, in forming and developing the literature and education of the people, as well as working for the spiritual benefit of both his subjects and his enemies. At that stage, it was unheard of that someone would be so concerned to win his enemies to Christ. To convert these savage foes, this sublime power to rise above the whole force of circumstances, to remain unbiased by the extremes of victory or defeat, to persevere in the teeth of disaster, to greet returning fortune with a cool eye, to have faith in men after repeated betrayals. This raises Alfred far above the turmoil of barbaric wars to the pinnacle of deathless victory. King Alfred really is exceptional. One cannot help but be amazed that a prince who lived in such turbulent times, who commanded personally in 54 pitched battles, who had so disordered a realm to regulate, who was not only a lawgiver but a judge, who was continually superintending his armies, his navies, and the traffic of his kingdom, his revenues and the conduct of his officers, that he could have bestowed so much of his time on religious exercises and speculative knowledge. But the exertion of all his faculties and virtues seemed to have given mutual strength to them all. He wasn't just a good war leader, he was a just leader and a good educator. So no wonder he is called the Great. King Alfred stands out as the model king, the perfect knight, the dedicated Christian, the Protestant before Protestantism, a soldier and a scholar, a rulemaker and an educator, an author and a reformer. He successfully fought against spiritual decay within the English church, as well as against the Viking invaders. He created the first English navy. He authored English literature. He ensured the survival of Christianity in England. He began the great process of converting the bloodthirsty Vikings to Christ. And so, this is how one finds the statue in his place of birth, Waltham. And this is what it reads. King Alfred the Great, the West Saxon king, born in Wantage, AD 849. Alfred found learning dead, and he restored it. Education neglected, and he revived it. The laws powerless, and he gave them force. The church debased, and he raised it. The land ravaged by a fearful enemy, from which he delivered it. Alfred's name shall live as long as mankind shall respect the past. Blessed be the Lord, my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle. He is my loving kindness and my fortress, my high tower and my deliverer, my shield and the one in whom I take refuge, who subdues the peoples under me. Stretch out your hand from above, rescue me and deliver me out of great waters, from the hand of foreigners, the one who gives salvation to kings, who delivers David from his servant from this deadly sword. Happy are the people whose God is the Lord. So, does anyone have any questions on that? Yes.
In light of Christian ethics and education, and as we see the king is really defending his country and fighting the people who are against Christianity, where do we draw the line as a Christian and the Bible and the law of God and the fighting? Because as a king, you have the sword and the shield of the Bible.
Yes.
So how do you fight? A good fight. Well, what happened that those days the law changed? Or well, what happened that now we cannot defend the knife, the sword, the shield of the Bible?
What happened indeed? Because biblically we are told if a thief breaks into your house at night and he strikes so that he dies, there's no guilt for his bloodshed. That's Exodus 22, verse 2. The law of God makes it clear that a man is responsible to protect his family. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, we read, If a man will not make provision for the members of his own family, especially the members of his own household, he has denied the faith and he is worse than infidel. There's a lot in the Bible that tells us to be willing to fight. Nehemiah 4 verse 14, fight for your wives, for your mothers, for your daughters, for your homes. And so you can see a man after God's own heart like King David, a man of war who could fight. Now, obviously, most armies in the world today are undisciplined and actually evil. Most of the governments of this world today are corrupt, and most of the wars of our time are without any benefit at all. They're just destruction of civilians and looting, and these things are not honorable, and no Christian would want to have anything to do with it. However, having said that, there are times in the Bible where God's people were involved in war, and there is a time to defend, but it's got to be to defend the innocent and the defenseless. It's got to be to protect, not to attack, not to be aggressive, not to steal and loot and none of that. Christians can't be involved in that. But if there are a fearful enemy coming and to fight to defend and to protect, that is right and good. And leaders should do it. And, for example, when the British invaded the Transvaal and the Free State back in 1899, President Steyner of the Orange Free State said, when a president declares war, he admits that he has failed. We politicians have failed to prevent this war. We have to declare war. But when we declare war, it means that we hand over to the army. And so now the army is running. And so General Christian De Wet was running the Orange Free State armies. And President Steyn said, Martinus Steyn, you cannot declare war and expect other men's sons to go to war if you don't go to war yourself. So he, as the president, went to war and he fought the whole time from 1899 to 1902 in the field. And later as a guerrilla, behind the lines, fighting for the freedom and independence of his country, taking his orders from his general, not interfering. He was the president. But he fought in the field because he said, I have no political duties until the war is over. And of course, when the peace treaty had to be discussed at Vereeniging, then he came to the table and he was part of the negotiations and organized so that in the end, the Orange Free State got back its independence and self-government, and South Africa became a union. And so President Steyn was one of the founders of our country, in the extent that he is the one who said the first act of the Union of South Africa, when the British colonies of France, of the Cape and of Natal joined with the Boer states, independent countries that had now been conquered by the British, of the Transvaal and the Free State, he said the first act must be to mint a coin, a half-cent coin, with two sparrows on it. For did not Jesus say, are not two sparrows sold for a single coin? Yet your Father cares for such as these. That God cares for the very least. Now, President Steyn was such a Christian leader, one of the most Christian heads of state the world's ever seen, that he recognized that he had to fight if he ordered other men to fight. And so he was in the field. I don't know when we last had a head of state in the field fighting with his men, but that's one example I know of President Steyn. So there is, biblically and in history, a time to fight to defend yourself against evil. And what the British were doing to the South African Boers was terrible. Concentration camps, destroying all the farms, poisoning the wells, killing all the livestock. It was scorched earth. It was total war. And the Boers were right to defend it and to resist. Now, I speak as one who is British. I've got no Boer in my background. My ancestry is not... I don't have any Afrikaans blood in my ancestry. And yet, I recognize that the British were wrong on that occasion and the Boers were right. It's the way it has to be. Like I say, my original ancestors who invaded England, the Vikings, they were the aggressors. But praise God for King Alfred, who started to win the Vikings to Christ. So I'm not talking tribe and nationality here. I'm trying to transgress that. As a Christian, I have a higher loyalty. So as a Christian, I believe we must fight. The Christians in South Sudan had a just war. They were fighting to defend their country from Muslims who were coming in and burning their churches, burning their villages, enslaving their people, crucifying their pastors. Of course the South Sudanese need to fight. So I was wholeheartedly, enthusiastically supporting our Christian brothers in Sudan who are fighting for their independence. It's a just fight. As for the Christians in Nuba Mountains, they're still fighting today. And so I found that as one example of just defense. Now, if you're in northern Nigeria today, each church will have a security ministry. because there's a danger of car bombs and terrorism. And so they have to, at every Sunday, we think in terms of protection, security. Otherwise, Muslims have driven a car right into churches and exploded in the middle of the church, driven right through the side and crashed into the pulpit area and exploded a suicide bomb. These have happened hundreds of times in northern Nigeria in the last 3 years. And so Christians in these areas recognize we need to be armed, we need to be trained, we need to be prepared, we need to be able to fight. So I believe as Christians, obviously we are not aggressive. And obviously we don't want to pick a fight with anyone. But if someone attacks, I need to be ready at a moment's notice to protect my wife and children and friends and fellow Christians. Example, 1993, 25th of July, 1993, five terrorists trained by Gaddafi's Libya burst into St. James Church of England in Cape Town, hurtled hand grenades into the midst of the congregation, opened fire with machine guns. Congregation of 1,500. One of my missionaries was there, and he fired back from the back of the church, hit the terrorist at the front with a little snub-nosed revolver, and forced them to flee. In the few seconds the attack had started, 11 people were killed and 55 were injured. But hundreds could have been killed, except for Jared Harker, 21-year-old, leapt on a hand grenade that landed in the aisle, and he absorbed the full impact of the grenade on himself to save the lives of people around him. Didn't even think twice, just he recognized grenade, fell in it, took the full impact. I saw him in a pool of blood. Got the pictures. And because of Jared Harker and because of Charles, who shot back, many lives were saved. And by the way, those terrorists all later caught, imprisoned, and Charles testified against them, and he later went and he took the Bible to them in prison, visited them many times, and shared the gospel with them too. So he did both. He showed love for his neighbors by protecting his neighbors in the heat of attack, but he showed love for his enemies afterwards by taking the gospel to them too. So I think there is this balanced side, and I have been trained as a soldier, and I have fought against terrorists who planted landmines and who killed civilians and protected schools and rescued whole schools that have been kidnapped to be taken into Angola to be trained to be communists and terrorists. Rescued them and reunited them to their parents. That's a wonderful thing, to be able to save lives. It's a privilege. But of course a Christian soldier cannot obey every order. There's some things that happen where we say, that is wrong, I cannot do that. Then you get into trouble. But as a Christian, there's things you will do and there's things you will not do. And so, as a Christian soldier, I got into trouble because I had standards and I had a high loyalty to our commander-in-chief, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. And so I think it is a great thing for a Christian to have the privilege of saving lives. And I think we all owe a debt of gratitude to the Christians in Sudan who have fought Islam and held the line. Because if South Sudan had fallen, Uganda and Kenya would have been next in the attacks. What South Sudan did was they held the line, they protected the rest of Africa from southward advance of Islam. What our Christian brothers are doing in northern Nigeria is stopping Islam. Very vital. Or the rest of the continent would be endangered. So we need to have this attitude in our churches of training. I train my children, my boys and my girls, to fight. Because the way the world is today, the girls are not exempt because they are targets too. While the boys should be the ones fighting, sometimes the girls might be in danger. So from the youngest, I've trained all my children in all the arts of war and all of our missionaries. We get death threats. I've got death threats. The Muslims have given death threats to me. Even the governor of Sudan has given me death threats on the official governor of Sudan website. Peter Hammond should expect to be bombed every time he comes to Sudan. He should expect to be shot on sight. Ministry of Foreign Affairs, governor of Sudan, says that on their website. When I produced the Sudan book, I got death threats from the governor of Sudan. When I produced the slavery, terrorism, and Islam book, I got death threats from Muslims, even delivered to our gates and to our mission and to our home. And so we've got to train all of our mission and our family, even my young children, what to do in a bomb situation, what to do in unarmed combat, disarming, fighting, so on, shooting range, everything that's necessary. I think that's necessary. In many parts of the world, Islam is a clear and present danger. If we don't prepare our Christians to be able to fight and defend, Islam will run over all of Africa. We have to be like our brothers in Sudan and fight. We don't want to fight the Muslims, but if they want to fight us, we will not bow. We will stand. We will resist. And so, we would be very happy to teach principles for self-defense to any Christians who want it. I consider it an essential sacred duty that we know how to fight efficiently, because we live in a wicked world, and there's some evil people, and Islam has effectively declared war against all Christians. So, Sudan, Nigeria, these are some of our mission fields. That has affected my way of thinking, and I believe what King Alfred did, we need leaders like that today. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
That's a good your presentation. You said when King Alfred the Great.
Yes.
Yeah, you said that he baptized King Grantham of Venice and the Fifth Earls.
Well, he didn't personally baptize them. He insisted they be baptized. As a king, he knew that there's a separation between church and state. His ministers would have done the baptism. But as a king who had defeated them, he spared their life, which they wouldn't have done for him if they'd beaten him, on condition that they be baptized and be discipled as Christians.
Okay, yeah. At the end, he said that they were the first Vikings of it. So I'm just
Sir, whose name?
The meaning of Vikings.
Vikings! Ah, the Vikings, yes. We'll have a session on that. And you've got a chapter on the Vikings. The Vikings are the Scandinavians, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Swedes. Now, the Vikings were the most ferocious warriors the world has ever seen. They came by sea and they came ferociously and they came with sword and axe and they beat everybody, everywhere. Nobody could beat them. And when Italy and Sicily need to be liberated from the Muslims, they called the Vikings, said, we'll pay you if you liberate them. They cleaned the Muslims out of there so fast. Muslims couldn't run fast enough. The Vikings were the most ferocious threat the church had ever seen. So they are known as the Norsemen or the Northmen, or the Vikings, or the Scandinavians. But they were the most ferocious threat and warriors the world had ever seen, and they fought for over 200 years, and they conquered England in the end. In 1066, the Vikings, the Normans, came in and took, Normans being for Northmen, took England. So England came under Viking kings in 1066 by William the Conqueror. So the Vikings are, well, yeah, they're my ancestors. They're the most brutal, ferocious, violent people the world had ever seen. And the Vikings were brought to Christ by King Alfred the Great to start with. But we'll have more details on how they were converted tomorrow, because the evangelism of the Vikings is quite an extraordinary example of missions history. Any other questions or comments? Yes, another question.
You've talked about this great King Alfred. The question is it right to force someone to be converted to Christ? Because this man, he said, to force these people, because he saw that he wanted to take them to slavery. So he said, don't take them to slavery, you have to be converted. Now, when these people are converted or they are scared of being taken to slavery, and is it right to force someone to be converted to Christ?
Yes. I understand what you're saying. Of course, we understand you cannot compel someone to be converted. We understand we use prayer and persuasion, instruction, preaching of the word. We want people of their own free will to surrender their life to Christ. We know this is the way. This is the correct way. However, let us be fair to bear in mind these are people 1,200 years ago in a very violent time. So we need to understand the context to be fair. But understand by the rules of warfare at that time, fighting these ferocious enemies who took no mercy. They either killed or enslaved the ones they defeated. He defeats them. And instead of enslaving them or killing them, as he could have done, they were in his power. He said, I want to make a treaty with you. I want to live in peace with you. I don't want to kill you. But I can't trust you if you're pagans. Because I know you're pagans. You lie. You don't keep your word. I need you to be converted to Christ and be baptized as Christians and discipled, because then you will keep your word. If you're not a Christian, your word will mean nothing. And so I want a treaty with you, and the only way I can have a treaty with you is if you're a Christian. So you must be converted. Now, he gave them actually no choice. He told them, you must be converted. Now, we know that this may not have made anyone regenerate. They may not have been born again at this point. But it brought them under the authority of Christianity. And as a condition, they had to destroy their idols of Thor and Odin, Freya and the others. And now they had to allow disciple makers, monks and priests to come and disciple them and teach them what it means to be a Christian. Now at this point, evangelism is taking place. We're not suggesting that at the point of the sword, the man's been converted. Not really. But because he's been compelled to make a public commitment to Christianity, it makes him now open to preaching and evangelism. And it's at that point that the Vikings really got saved. And if you look at it this way, if I can use another example. In South Africa, the most ferocious soldiers the world had ever seen in Africa were the Zulus. Do we have any Zulus amongst us? Yes. King Shaka, great king, powerful. He struck terror in the hearts of his enemies. What the Zulus did in the Mifokan and Difokan just devastated vast areas. And they conquered and they slaughtered across. And the Zulus had missionaries amongst them. There was American and there was British missionaries for 20 years amongst Dingaan and Shaka without a single convert. Not one Zulu was converted before 1838. Until the Boers beat them in battle, there wasn't a single convert. They had evangelists there, they had missionaries amongst them, but the people were too afraid of the witch doctors and too afraid of the kings to make a public commitment to Christ. Maybe there were some secret converts, but there was no baptism. But once they were militarily defeated, and they saw the Christian God must be more powerful than our chiefs and our witch doctors, people started to come to Christ. And when the British defeated them at the Battle of Ulundi, then huge amounts of Zulus came to Christ. Same in Zimbabwe, what was then Rhodesia. The Madibili had missionaries for 38 years, including Robert Moffat and his son, ministered amongst Mzilikazi and Lubengula. They knew the gospel, but nobody gave their lives to Christ. No open baptisms amongst the Madibili. Why? They were too afraid of the witch doctor and too afraid of the king. But once they were defeated in battle, 1893, then Madibili came to Christ by the hundreds of thousands. And I say the same about the Vikings. Until the Vikings, my ancestors, were beaten in battle, they would not turn to Christ. But when they were beaten, they said, the Christian God must be more powerful than the idols we pray to. Then they were open to being converted. So, if I can use another example in history. At the end of the Second World War, the Americans had beaten the Japanese. The Japanese were Shintos. They worshipped the emperor. General MacArthur, the American general who was in charge of the whole Pacific front, he comes to Japan, and the emperor of Japan, Horiyoshi, has to come before him now. Now, the emperor has been worshipped as a god. The emperor's the god of the Japanese, Shintoism. And he says, I suppose I must be baptized as a Christian. And General MacArthur, so influenced by his Baptist individualism of America, says, oh no, that's a private decision. Now I must say, as a missionary and as a historian, that was a wrong decision. General MacArthur, good general though he was a terrible evangelist. He should have said, yes, tomorrow. If the emperor of the Japanese had been converted and been baptized, all of Japan would have got converted. Now, don't say they'd have got born again, but they would have then abandoned Shintoism and Buddhism, and they would have been open to preaching and teaching and evangelism, and then many millions would have gotten saved. So I say that the Americans were wrong not to demand the conversion of the emperor of Japan. When they beat him, how wonderful it would have been if Japan could have been converted. And if you know your history, and I'll show you as we go through more tomorrow, most of Europe was converted by the king getting converted and ordering his subjects to get converted. That's the way it started. Now, we're not saying that that's when they were born again. We're saying that's when they became open to evangelism. because now they'd thrown away the idols of the past. And they'd embraced Christianity in theory, officially, and now the discipleship and evangelism takes place. So, to me, the Americans made a terrible, disastrous failure. They really missed the opportunity of the century when, in 1945, they turned down the offer of the Japanese emperor to be converted. He should have said yes. In fact, when Americans conquered Iraq recently in Kuwait, in our lifetimes, I think they should have insisted on abolishment of Islam and enforced conversion to Christianity, because the Islam's what's fermenting the war there. You cannot have Islam and freedom. I think if you're going to fight a war, the least you might as well do is make sure that your enemies benefit spiritually. So, okay, I've gone quite far into modern contemporary issues away from history, but it's just the principle that historically I recognize that many people from the Vikings and the Russians and the Bulgarians and the Franks and the Manabili and the Zulus, they were converted to Christ once they were defeated in battle and their kings were formally converted. I believe that is key.